Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, can AI replace teachers in school?
And what one researcher says are the hidden themes in a popular video game.
But first this morning, state lawmakers are scrambling to step in to save an Arizona school district. Teachers are not being paid at the Isaac School District in West Phoenix, and there are no answers coming from the district yet about how long they can keep schools open. Now, teachers are weighing their options and how long they can work without pay.
No one behind me knows if they are getting paid tomorrow. Not one of them. Nobody behind here that has children in our schools knows if there is school on Wednesday.
That's Arizona Education Association president and Isaac teacher Mary Saul Garcia rallying outside the Capitol earlier this week. There is school today, but teachers like Garcia are still not being paid. It all comes after the State Board of Education put the district under receivership earlier this month. And KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez with our politics desk is here now to explain more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so all of this started, as we said, when we found out that the State Board of Ed put the district under receivership not that long ago. Tell us why. Like, what happened there?
Yeah, earlier this month, because it turns out that they're very, very deep in debt, like millions of dollars. It's a really bad situation, and it was discovered somewhat late, which is raising a lot of eyebrows, and especially the lawmakers are like, how did you let this happen? How did no one notice these red flags, or did people notice and they just let it happen?
Mm-hmm.
It's led to the treasurer, or the superintendent resigning. There's also been calls for the members of the school board to resign, and there's now legislation that would sort of force them out.
Right. Okay. And we'll get to that in a moment. So receivership is one thing. Debt, you know, we find out all of this financial situation is happening. But now it's a few weeks later and we find out teachers are suddenly not being paid. We don't know how long the schools can even stay open. How did we get here?
Right. And I'm kind of shocked that it's already gotten to this point, that it was allowed to get to this point, even though, you know, there's been a lot of finger pointing about who should be fixing this problem and whose fault it is. Sort of what's been decided is that the legislature is going to have to step in and fix this problem. But usually it's not the legislature making these decisions for payroll for a school district. The county treasurer is taking a lot of heat. He's saying, well, I can't just keep cutting checks to a district that's in the in the red like this. It's not part of my job. They're under receivership, which is super rare, by the way, by many millions of dollars, and it can't be on me anymore.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get to the legislature and what's happening there. There's a bit of a scramble among lawmakers to try to pass some legislation to at least sort of stopgap this, it sounds like. What would it do?
Right. So this bill is an emergency piece of legislation, which would give them about $2.5 million. That's enough to keep them going for about 2 weeks. So it's just a temporary fix. Mm-hmm. Now, the Democrats and members of the, you know, teachers and such are saying, we would really like a permanent fix now, please, and not have to worry about whether we're doing this again in 2 weeks. But the people pushing the bill are saying, well, we need to keep them above water and make sure that the 5,000 or so kids are getting an education across these 12 schools for the time being. But we also need to address the much bigger situation here, and we can't just bail them out for the rest of the school year by throwing cash at this problem.
So talk about that bigger situation, what a longer-term solution might look like.
Well, there's definitely talk of dissolving this school district after this year. But the pledge from leaders in the state legislature is that they're going to keep Isaac open at least for the rest of this school year. And for the next 2 weeks, teachers will get paid. I think the earliest teachers could get checks is Thursday or Friday. That's presuming that the legislature gets down to business and addresses the problem today, which would require a lot of effort and procedural changes. But it's possible. They can work that fast if they want to.
What are teachers saying now? They're continuing to go to work without pay?
Well, they're frustrated. I think it's on a teacher-by-teacher basis about how long they can work without getting paid because, you know, for some people, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, maybe it's, you know, you don't have the luxury of just showing up to work and hoping that you'll get paid because people said that they're going to try to help you in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone sort of has the same shared goal. It's across the board bipartisan about keeping the kids in school. And I think, you know, teachers are going all out above and beyond, at least for the time being, just to make it through the middle of this week and this uncertainty. But it is a pretty crazy situation to be in, and it's a wild ask.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about this provision in the proposed legislation here that would at least fix this for a couple of weeks, that, mm-hmm. that would remove the school board. Can they do that?
That's another interesting question. So this bill says that, you know, in this very specific situation of a district under receivership, that the superintendent and school board would basically get fired. Now, that is an interesting precedent to set because the school board members are elected. Mm-hmm. And so you have the situation of elected officials, the lawmakers, getting rid of other elected officials. And right. in this case, the higher superintendent, the county one, Shelley Boggs, would get the authority to replace them, handpick people to replace the school board members.
Would politics come into play here, Cameron?
I think at this point, people are just desperate to fix this problem, and they're going to talk about the semantics and the precedent of that later. At least that's what I would assume, because mm-hmm. the fire is currently burning, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. There's federal money also coming in, but it wouldn't necessarily go to teachers. That's right?
Right. So they didn't spend about $9 million in COVID relief funds from the federal government that got taken back, reverted. And then we asked for that money to back, please. We said, actually, we have a problem here. So the federal government sent $6 million back. But the county treasurer, as I mentioned before, said, well, this has to go to paying down your $28.5 million of debt. We can't just give this to the payroll. We can't just give this to teacher salaries. That's not in our purview. So unfortunately, yes.
Okay, so a lot still up in the air, a lot to watch for yet to come. That is Cameron Sanchez with KJZZ's Politics Desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Arizona death row inmate Aaron Gunches has asked to be executed next month. This comes as Governor Katie Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Mays have said they're prepared to restart using lethal injection after pausing capital punishment when they took office 2 years ago, pending a review of the practice. But as my next guest explains, there are still questions about the manner in which the state puts people to death. Michael Kiefer is a longtime reporter in Arizona and a current contributor to the Arizona Mirror. He's been writing about this, and when I spoke with him earlier, we started with the supply the state has of one of the ingredients needed to make pentobarbital, which is the drug used in lethal injections. But it sounds like it's not being stored in a way people might think it would be.
Last week, I sat down with David Duncan. He's the retired magistrate judge, federal magistrate judge, that Governor Katie Hobbs had contracted with to do an evaluation of the state's lethal injection protocol. And over the course of that discussion, he described to me, you know, among the things he had learned, that here were these crystals, this material. It's called an API, for active pharmaceutical ingredient for pentobarbital salt, that was stored in a refrigerator in a facility in Florence run by, you know, the Arizona Department of Corrections. And he was a bit taken aback. Here were these jars. They looked like mason jars. Mm-hmm. Here was this powder. No labels on the jars. And he wondered, what kind of doctor would take a material from an unmarked jar and inject it into a body? And that started him thinking about it. And it started him asking questions about whether the chemical was still viable. Now, these drugs are otherwise unavailable. So what happened was there was a company in Connecticut, and this is information that I only got on the record last week, called Absolute Standards in Connecticut, that saw a hole in the market and started to manufacture this API, active pharmaceutical ingredient, to satisfy these needs. Now, one of the things that I also learned last week from a federal defender in Tennessee, who had gone to this company in order to find out how to obtain it for executions in her state. And they told her that it had a shelf life of 2.5 years. Judge Duncan was told by the state of Arizona that it had a permanent shelf life, that it was going to be fine. And he was doubtful about that. So this raises the question as to, A, will it work? The other question is perhaps more serious. What has been emerging over the last several years was that pentobarbital has this other effect that wasn't foreseen, which is that it triggers what they call a flash edema. It is so caustic that immediately the tissues in the lungs start to collapse, fluid rushes in, fills the lungs, and basically the person drowns in his or her own body fluids. There are anesthesiologists who have compared this to the torture waterboarding. So when we see this person who is unresponsive, and unresponsive doesn't mean you can't feel pain. It means you can't move. It means you can't react. They may, in fact, and most likely, are suffering this very painful drowning-like death.
Let me ask you about the issue of whether or not the ingredient is still viable, if it's expired or not. What are the implications of that, especially if, A, people don't really know if it's expired or not, or B, if it actually is expired and the people conducting the executions are still using it?
Well, we don't really know. The state, even today, I got the Arizona Attorney General's office referred me back to a letter that Corrections Director Ryan Thornell had sent to Governor Hobbs back in November, saying, "Don't worry, we've tested these drugs. Supposedly, they're going to be tested by the Department of Public Safety labs," and gave assurances. So, who knows? I mean, they are firm that that the drug is fine, at least from what they're telling me. So that's the one question. They are confident that that the drug is still viable. The other question remains. Now, just a few days ago, outgoing Attorney General Merrick Garland issued an order saying that the federal government, the Department of Justice, will no longer use pentobarbital for these reasons. Of course, he's on his way out.
Right.
Just on January 20th, one of the many executive orders issued by incoming President Trump was that, yes, we're going to go forward with executions. It's a great deterrent, which is debatable. And among the other things he said is that he's going to promise every state that has capital punishment that they will have a sufficient supply of the drugs needed to do it. Now, where those drugs come from is anyone's guess.
At the same time, there are states that are looking to move away from lethal injection as their method of execution, right? I mean, you referenced Judge Duncan. He, in his report, suggested that maybe a firing squad would be a better, more humane option here.
Well, what Judge Duncan actually said, as he explained it to me, is that the possibility of screwing it up is less with a firing squad. I don't, he brought along a caveat that, look, you're ending someone's life. It's violent. You're taking a life away from someone who doesn't want to die. So there are other states that have that are trying asphyxiation by nitrogen. The problem with that is that when you're executing someone, they aren't volunteering to die.
Usually.
Usually.
I mean, Aaron Gunch is being potentially the exception to that rule, right?
Yes. That's another question, that I find very interesting with the case of Aaron Gunches. And I've covered some of his appeals in the past. Aaron Gunches killed a man in 2002, I believe, and he went on the lam. And then he was pulled over by a cop. He got into a gunfight with a cop. He shot the cop. He went to trial, and he refused to put up any defense. So here's a man who's been incarcerated for 20 some years, who was resigned to the fact that he killed someone, and do with me what you may. And I think it's also a statement of how, this notion of the death penalty is the deterrence. It's for some, it's a harsher punishment to be spending the rest of your life locked up.
So what are state officials, and maybe what does Judge Duncan say about what all of what he found and what we've been talking about, what does it all mean for the future of capital punishment in Arizona?
Well, there's this unwillingness to listen. And as I've said many times, the less you know about the death penalty, the stronger are your beliefs for or against. When you actually start to learn about it, it's a very gray area. It's complex, and you come up with these sort of paradoxical questions.
All right. That is journalist Michael Kiefer. Michael, thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, is the video game Animal Crossing New Horizons promoting capitalism and colonialism? We'll hear one NAU grad's argument.
But first, the sober living home scandal that rocked Arizona when it came to light in 2023 was one of the biggest in state history. It involved thousands of mostly Native American people who were seeking help for addiction to drugs and alcohol, often picked up on reservations throughout the region and driven to so-called sober living homes in the valley. Only that help often never came. Instead, providers billed Arizona's Medicaid program or access for services they never provided, to the tune of millions of dollars with no limit. Now there is a class action lawsuit alleging the state was negligent and should be held responsible. And our next guest found the whole thing led to at least 40 deaths and likely many more. Mary Hudetz covers tribal issues for ProPublica, which published the report alongside the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting this week.
We did want to start to understand who the victims are. There's been some reporting, mostly owing to lawsuits, on individual victims, but I continuously heard from advocates and people affected by this crisis that they wanted to see attention given to the victims and accountability for their deaths. And the way we went about doing this reporting was to look closely at records from the Office of the Medical Examiner in Maricopa County, which investigates deaths in a lot of cases that are believed to be accidental, homicide. And so we took that data after filing a public records request, and we're able to decipher through our analysis like who may have died in a part-time living space. And then often the medical examiner's notes say very clearly the death happened in a sober living home.
Right.
And that's how we were able to find the 40 victims. And then also to find specifically the man whose story we told in this story this week, which was Jeffrey Histito.
Yeah. Tell us about him. You spoke with his family, as you said, and this is a tough story. Like, he was finally getting treatment, it sounded like, from his family's perspective. They were glad.
Yeah, his family is one of multiple that I've spoken to. And a lot about his story, I feel, is representative of what I heard from many families. And of course, he entered treatment in the Phoenix area in 2021, made a decision to enter treatment for alcoholism. And that was a decision that made his family very happy. I think listeners who may have a loved one who's also dealing with addiction will understand like what it means when their family member decides they're ready to get, you know, really want to do the work to get well. And so they were, as they told me, thrilled. And of course, within a matter of months, they started to see that it wasn't working. He was struggling in ways, but yet I think one of the key things is that they were in the dark to the fact that there was this burgeoning fraud crisis happening, and they had no way, no knowledge or tools to understand that, the
right
extent to which they might want to intervene.
Right. And when you say, like, the 40 deaths that you were able to tally here, there's likely many more. How many more? Like, this scandal was extensive.
Yes, it was extensive. The state says there are at least 300 providers who may have billed fraudulently, thousands of people recruited into the homes. That's according to what Access has told us in the past. And I would say advocates such as Reva Stewart, who has been doing outreach with the community to work with those who are affected, believes there could be hundreds.
Wow.
If not more, victims.
I want to talk about the state's response to this, right? You're also digging into what was going on at the state level as these people were sometimes dying. The Hobbs administration has pointed to the Ducey administration saying, you know, this happened under their watch. But your reporting shows that they also sort of fumbled, as you call it, the response to this. Tell us how.
Yeah. You know, the Hobbs administration came into office in January of 2023. It seems like they started to piece together over the following month. They knew, I think, to some extent that there was fraud happening, but understanding the scale and scope of it took mm-hmm. them some weeks, according to the governor's office. From there, they started to take action to develop a response. They attribute like the fact that it's a very complex scheme to wanting to create a response that was probably like met the moment, met the scale of the fraud. But we did find, for instance, that there seemed to be a bit of a pause or stalling around setting a rate on how much providers could collect. Providers could bill unlimited amounts right. of money to Medicaid. So by setting a cap on how much people could claim, then that would start to sort of de-incentivize the fraudulent billing. You know, we weren't able to receive an explanation from Access, the state Medicaid agency, as to why its director held off on setting a cap on those reimbursement rates mm-hmm. in the spring of 2023. But records show that that is something that happened before a couple of weeks later, the rate was then capped.
What has Access had to say about what you found here? What has the state said in response?
Access has limited comment in response to our reporting. They are citing the class action lawsuit as a reason, which is common. Many agencies, if they're facing litigation, will withhold comment. The governor's office has said that they wish the Ducey administration had given them more information during the transition. Ducey's spokesperson has their own response to that. But I mean, I would say since May of 2023, the state has been taking a lot of action very publicly to try to, you know, root out bad providers by suspending payments to them, conducting investigations, creating a hotline for people who may have been in fraudulent facilities and mm-hmm. needed to return to their homes. You know, and all that said, though, I guess that kind of takes me back to like the main focus of the story, that amid all those efforts, there hadn't actually really been much, as far as we know, any communication or outreach to the victims' families, the families of people who died.
They have not heard from the state at this point?
Yeah. You know, an example of the Histito family, which again is a representative of what I've heard from every family I've interviewed so far, is they've just never heard from the state at all. Jeffrey Histito passed away in December 2022, and it really wasn't until the spring of 2023 that this crisis was understood a bit more fully. Mm-hmm. And I think in a case like that, I think families are piecing together what happened to their loved one on their own, or still very much in the dark regarding information to their loved one's death.
Okay. We'll leave it there for now. That is Mary Hudetz, a tribal issues reporter for ProPublica, who joins us to talk about her recent investigation alongside the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting on the Sober Living Home scandal. Mary, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We also reached out to Access about this. They sent us a statement saying they have acknowledged the pain and suffering associated with this fraud and are committed to working with tribal partners and law enforcement to protect Access members. You can read their entire statement on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. And this is The Show.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. AI is banking its way into education, and fast. And while many people's initial reaction to it was to restrict it, to prevent cheating, plagiarism, misinformation, others are going all in. One new charter school called Unbound Academy made waves recently when it was approved by the Arizona State Board of Charter Schools to start a virtual school where students will use AI platforms to learn core instructions for 2 hours per day. An AI tutor will see how students are doing on individualized learning plans. Teachers, meanwhile, will take on the role of guides. It's the first school of its kind here, and it's a sign of the times in which schools around the country are increasingly using AI. And our next guest doesn't think we should run away from it. Jessica Early is an English professor at ASU. She studies the teaching of writing, including in AI.
I spoke with her more about this new AI teaching model and how she sees the technology both benefiting and hindering education.
Well, I'm still excited about AI and the teaching of writing. However, I'm really interested in the ways that we can empower teachers and give them agency and really involve them in the use of AI and in the planning of curriculum and instruction in connection with their expertise, not as a replacement of their expertise. So I think for me, the biggest question is, how can teachers design AI so that humans are intricately woven in and looped in to the process of teaching students? Because AI isn't disconnected from the human world.
Right.
And it has all this information that we provide and feed it. But it's only useful in an education setting, I think, when experts are involved in creating really amazing inquiry projects for students with it and using it as a point of reflection and a launching pad. I think AI as a replacement for teachers is really problematic.
So I want to dig into that a little bit. That's an interesting reaction and a nuanced one. Talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done in this realm, looking at the use of AI in teaching, particularly for writing for you. Where does it work? Like, how does it work well?
So I've been working with a group in New York and in connection to the National Writing Project. And we are looking at the way teachers of writing, particularly at the secondary level, can use AI as a thinking partner for students in their writing process. So for example, there's a teacher in Philadelphia that we're partnering with, and she's having students work on writing letters to the next president and using AI in peer review and asking AI to give responses to student writing. So they're the creators and generators of the letters to the next president. But then AI is giving suggestions for ways to make the pieces stronger in a way that you would have a peer review with another student. So Sure. It's just another lens into the writing.
I want to ask you more about this idea you said about AI being a tool for teachers as opposed to being a replacement for teachers. Mm-hmm. What's important in that in your work and your research? Like, is it about sort of the human interaction that students get? Is it about how AI can be susceptible to misinformation, that kind of thing? What are the concerns?
I think the concern is that we forget how incredible teachers are at reaching students where they are, understanding the nuances of state standards, but also reaching way above those. So I think thinking of ways that AI can only support and add to what they're already doing rather than taking away what they're doing and replacing it. And I also think that idea of false information, and I think starting with their own writing, their own ideas, their own reactions to text, and then using AI only to enliven or enrich or to add to what they're doing is helpful. The minute that we replace something completely, like human interaction and support and guidance, I think that takes away the value of what we have in schools as social contexts and settings.
Let me ask you about the broader context here, because this certainly isn't the only, you know, kind of experiment in education using AI. Like, you talked about ways in which you're using it and which you think it's being used really well and is helpful. What does the landscape look like in terms of AI making its way into classrooms?
Well, I think there's a whole gamut of things happening and that we don't completely know all the things that are happening. I mean, I think there are some. There's a huge reaction, which is just keep it out, like let's not use it. Then there's other incredibly innovative and creative teachers who are doing things like in the National Writing Project, where they're using AI as a tool and thinking of ways to enliven, innovate, and shift their teaching practices to have students recognize how powerful it is, its flaws, and the ways that it can really help our writing and literacy and thinking in the world. And then I think there's a lot of programs and innovation where we're trying to create shortcuts in learning. And this is what I think we want to push against. I think, you know, learning to write, for example, is hard and it's complicated. And the purpose of writing is social. We write for social contexts and purposes. So I think we want to really be careful about replacing teachers, human teachers and social context and peers you know, it's a whole new map that's out there. And one of the things that we need to do in education is see what's happening, but also really push for teachers' excellence.
So do you think that as schools start to experiment with this technology in various ways that you kind of just outlined there, like, do you think it's moving too fast? Do you think that it's moving too slow in some places? Like, are there guides in our state for how classrooms, how teachers, how school model makers should use this?
In terms of guide, the National Council of Teachers of English, there's different programs and researchers who are coming out with that language, with guides for how to think about this. But I, to be really honest, I don't think we know yet.
Yeah.
It's so new. I think we need to play around with it before we start using it as a model for education. So we need to know what it does and all the possibilities as it's changing, if that makes sense. Like, it's always going to be changing. Education is always changing. Literacy is always changing. But I think if we just start by creating something and changing education completely using AI, that's dangerous. That we need to, like, really reflect and notice how students are using it and taking it up. This is the value of research, to understand what's happening. And that's why, like, I'm a part of a research group right now in the National Writing Project looking at this with teachers in their classrooms to see how they're using it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super exciting.
Okay. We'll leave it there for now. Jessica Early, an English professor at ASU who researches writing and studies the teaching of writing, including in AI. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
We also reached out to Unbound Academy to see if they would like to talk about this story. They did not respond to our requests.
A new novel questions the reliability of storytelling, both fictional and non-fictional. The show Sam Dingman has the, well, story.
Nnedi Okorafor has written over 20 books. Her stories explore the worlds of sci-fi and fantasy, using alternate histories and futuristic utopias to ask provocative questions about the fate of humanity. But in her latest book, Death of the Author, Nnedi is asking her deepest question yet. Death of the Author is a novel about a paraplegic Nigerian-American author named Zelu. At a moment of crisis in her literary career, Zelu gets an idea for a novel about storytelling robots. The book becomes an overnight bestseller, and its success transforms Zelu's life. Among other things, she meets a scientist who invites her to test out an experimental piece of wearable technology that might enable her to walk again. And as Zelu's story unfolds, our perspective on it as readers changes. Some chapters take the form of transcripts from interviews with Zelu's friends and family members. Other sequences are lifted from the pages of the fictional robot novel, much of which overlaps with the themes of Zelu's story. And on top of all this, Nnedi, the author of Death of the Author, is, in real life, a disabled Nigerian-American writer. When I spoke with Nnedi recently, she told me that this uncertainty about what the real story is intentional.
The greatest path to truth is through the voice of many. So Zelu, she's Nigerian-American. Another tenet of Nigerian-Americanness is the community above the individual. So if we have a story about Zelu, we can't tell that story with just Zelu telling her story. We're going to have to hear from her family. We're going to have to hear from many to understand who she is. She can't tell you who she is. The community can, and that community includes her.
Yeah. Well, and that's a fascinating answer also because it gets at kind of the main question of the book, I would argue, which is, are we the authors of our own stories? And the other sequences in the book that are really interesting are the ones where we read excerpts from this book that Zelu sits down and writes that becomes a bestseller. And it made me wonder, there's a twist at the end where we are sort of invited to consider which of the narratives that we have been reading holds primacy.
Mm-hmm.
When did you arrive at the idea that you were interested in messing with which of those was, quote unquote, the real world?
I think it was well before I started writing this book.
Okay.
These are themes because I've always played with the idea of story and the line between fiction and non-fiction. Like, from the beginning of writing, I was like already kind of playing with this line of what is fiction, what is not, what is story. And then I was in conversation with this idea of, is the written word the ultimate type of storytelling? But what about oral storytelling? I'm Nigerian. You know, that's one of the epitomes of story. So I've always been playing with these things. So it's always been in the back of my head. So like when I sat down to write this thing where I didn't know what I was writing and it just became this, it's an accident, but not an accident at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. No, that makes sense. If I'm hearing you right, though, it sounds like you gave yourself permission to go deeper on some things that you had wanted to go deeper on for some time. And just ask you about one of the specifics of that. In Zelu, we as readers are shown a version of living with a disability, which is we see Zelu have romantic relationships. We see at some point she has an opportunity to perhaps undergo a procedure that will allow her to walk when she has not been able to walk for a very long time. And then her like identity as a disabled person is called into question.
Mm-hmm.
Would those elements of the story be an example of something that you were able to go deeper on here that you hadn't been able to previously?
Yeah, I think so. It's really that line between nonfiction and fiction, because I have a lot to say about disability. You know, she's paraplegic. And what does it mean to be this type of woman, but yet, you know, have lots of boyfriends and have this attitude of like, I don't care about relationships. I like men. I'm going to do this. And what does that mean for someone like her? What does it mean when her identity is questioned? You know, when you take off that identity of disability while you still have it, you discover a new strength. You discover a shakiness as well. And I think that writing Zelu and writing her going through these things kind of helped me deal with those things.
It strikes me also in the way that you answered that there is a connection to another element in the story, which is particularly in the science fiction sequences of the book. There is a lot of discussion about the role of stories. And Zelu is brought into confrontation over the course of the narrative with her own story of who she is, the story of the way her family sees her, the story of the way the culture sees disabled people in general, the story of the way the culture sees artists and writers in general. And then in the science fiction sequence, we have this interrogation of whether stories are productive or not.
Yeah, I mean, this book is looking at the importance of our stories. And I think in this time of AI and AI generating stories, we need to look at what is important about our stories and why are they important? What makes them specific to us? Because now you've got this concept of AI-generated stories, and what is that? So, yeah, I think that this book is definitely defining what it is that's important about our stories.
That's so interesting, because for me, one of the things that's very effective about the conclusion of the book is that to me it really forces me as a reader into confrontation with whether or not I can trust all of these very carefully observed specifics that we have been talking about in the rest of this conversation, how much of them do in fact originate from some author and who that author might be. I mean, is that an indication that of any fearfulness on your part that automated writing tools might one day be able to develop that level of observation? Or is that perhaps an indictment of me as a reader for realizing that I might fall for it?
You know, I don't think that people should be afraid of falling for it. I don't even think that's the problem. I think the question and the issue is underneath that. I think that like the deeper issue is like intent. It's funny that I'm going to say this, but fine, I'm going to say this. If AI are intelligent, if they are sentient, if we have sentient AI, I'd have no problem with them writing stories. I would read their stories. And I believe sentient AI will side with the creatives. I really do. They're going to be like, these are ours. Why are you taking our stuff and using it for whatever?
That is the most holistic perspective on AI that I have ever heard, Nettie. I have to say, I haven't ever heard it put that way, that if we assume the idea that AI could develop sentience, in so many of the conversations about it, the immediate next step in most of our minds, at least in the popular discourse, is that sentience would be used to exploit. That
right.
Sentience.
That's okay. So it keeps coming back to intent.
Yeah.
That's always been my argument when it comes to the technology. It's the technology is not the problem. It's the people, human beings, who are the problem. It's what are we going to do with it? How do we use it? What is our intent? Is our intent to exploit people and destroy whatever, just so we can gather as much capital as possible? Or are we trying to make the world a better place? Like, we're at a crossroads here. We can go this way or that way, and it is up to us.
There's that question again. Are we perhaps willing to be the authors?
Yes.
Of the story?
Exactly.
Well, Nettie Okorafor is the author of Death of an Author, where these questions and many others are pondered. Nettie, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. When the video game Animal Crossing New Horizons debuted in 2020, it seemed like the timing was perfect. Lots of people were stuck at home, and the game itself seemed to have a calming effect, with cute and at least digitally cuddly animals as the main characters. But for my next guest, the game is actually much more than a way to pass the time. Ryan Binkley got his master's from NAU this past spring, where his thesis was based on the game. It's called Cute and Cuddly Criminals: Colonialism, Consumerism, and the Mass Ornament in Animal Crossing New Horizons. And as you may have guessed from the title, it takes a critical view of the game. I spoke earlier with Binkley about his research, and we started with what initially piqued his interest in this.
So I started playing the game as soon as it came out, like everybody else on the planet, during when COVID-19 really started, hit everybody in lockdown in March. That's when the game came out, was in March 2020. And my sister had a copy, and so we were just kind of playing it back and forth. And the more that I was playing it, I kind of thought to myself, this is a little weird, a little off, if you kind of look at it from the lens of like an environmental perspective of like how you're going into this quote unquote deserted island, and the entire premise of the game is to turn it into a profitable tourist attraction. And I'm like, huh, that's a little weird. And so I had that idea for a while. I originally was going into it from like an environmental ideology perspective, but then the more that I started playing the game and researching more, I landed on a colonialist lens.
In the sense that you are going to this place and basically taking it over.
Yes, exactly.
I wonder if at any point you were thinking, I'm reading too much into a video game. Like, this is not like a novel. This is not a movie. This is a video game that's aimed at kids. Like, was there any thought in your mind about that?
Yes, and that's exactly why I think it's important to take a look into these things.
Ah.
So specifically, there's... I think that uncritically engaging with media that sort of cultivates justification and consent for practices like going into places and taking it over in the name of profit guarantees their persistence.
Well, so I wonder if in some ways the fact that it is kind of a calm video game, it's certainly not like a real shoot 'em up kind of thing. Like the fact that it's directed at kids, it's kind of a pastoral setting with, you know, animals and, you know, seems kind of friendly. In your mind, does that make it maybe, I don't want to say problematic, but maybe more interesting that some of these themes are involved?
Yes, absolutely. So there's an entire section of my thesis that goes over pastoralism in its entirety, and like that as a massive component of the game. So it's particularly in what Leo Marx in the 60s, very important, Leo Marx, not Karl. But Leo Marx talked about it as this concept of sentimental pastoralism, which is this very American idea of, you know, the what he referred to as like the outdoors wilderness cult, how like we have a we have this almost like fetishization of like camping and natural in like, you know, national parks and things like that, while at the same time having this like rapacious appetite for consumerist products that can only exist with the exploitation of those resources.
I wonder if you heard anything from Nintendo about this. Like, did you have a chance to ask them any of these questions about whether or not like this was an intentional thing or not?
No, I did not have a chance to like sit down with any developers or anything. I think a lot of that is also like a language barrier, you know. Sure. There, it's a Japanese development game, but I also want to make it very clear that a lot of these things, by their very nature, are going to be unintentional. And I think that's really what's interesting about it, is the idea of video games as a vehicle for trafficking ideology.
How good are video games at getting these ideologies across? Like, how good of a vehicle are they?
I think they are probably, at least in my view, the most salient form of getting those ideologies across because of their interactive nature. In the game, you are the one building the settler spaces, the institutions, and the narratives, and you are enjoying it. It's training you to think like a colonialist and a capitalist in order to access its pleasures.
So I might be the only person on the planet who hasn't played Animal Crossing, but I have to say that when I was reading about it and looking at it, it struck me very much as a little bit like SimCity, a game that I have played.
And
even,
much so, yes.
Even a game maybe like Minecraft, where you know your job in some settings is to build buildings and, you know, collect materials and animals and things like that, but very much like taking control of the land. It sounds like, at least in the case of SimCity, you see some parallels here.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Those social simulation games absolutely have aspects of that colonial mindset of going in and taking over a land. I think especially when it comes to something like Minecraft, one of the things that I talk about a lot is the idea of terra nullius. So essentially, when it comes to colonialism, the idea is that, you know, land and nature have value only for human desires. And as such, land should be conquered and utilized by those who, quote unquote, know best. So when historically encountering indigenous people whose land use doesn't reflect this very Judeo-Christian utilitarian doctrine, colonizers historically have gone in and, quote unquote, civilized them. So the idea is that even something like Minecraft, when you're going in and you come across like villages, and they're not really doing a great job of like, quote unquote, cultivating the land and building things. So one of the most common things to do in a survival world in Minecraft is to find a village and just ransack everything and take all their stuff, because you're the one who knows how to actually use it better than they do. And I think, you know, over time, this anthropocentrism has really entered the realm of common sense. It's all well and good to say, like, in theoretical terms, yeah, sure, this is what video games are doing, but who cares? Like, this is why we need to care. So, like, those subtle, undetected disseminations of colonial ideology is essential for the preservation of global capitalist hegemony, upon which the prosperity of more quote-unquote developed nations depends. And the wealth that comes at the direct cost of ongoing ecological devastation and worker exploitation around the world. And for example, you know, like the Nintendo Switch is a contemporary consumer product that depends upon a rechargeable lithium-ion battery. And those are all manufactured using cobalt. And most of the world's cobalt supply is sourced from workers laboring in slave-like conditions in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So whenever someone's playing Animal Crossing New Horizons, whenever they engage in simulated acts of subjugation, exploitation, and consumption, they're doing so on a machine whose existence is dependent upon an industry that has ravaged the landscape of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I think uncritically engaging with media that cultivates justification and consent for those practices only guarantees their persistence.
That is Ryan Bingley, got his master's from NAU this past May.
All right, that's it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thanks for joining us as always, and be sure to join us tomorrow with much more. Don't forget you can follow us on Instagram as well. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.